Hi everybody, welcome along to Pastor. So if I do get a bit soft, please just raise your hand and I'll push out a bit more air. So get comfortable in your seat, please. Just wriggle about so your back feels straight and your shoulders are relaxed. Then just let your body breathe itself. Become aware of the movements of the body as it breathes itself. And relax into your awareness. And imagine the ground beneath you is of the nature of a starry sapphire light, and the air above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. And in the space in front of you, on a lion throne, sitting on a cushion of lotus, sun and moon, is the Buddha Shakyamuni. And he is surrounded by an assembly of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities, and other enlightened beings. And you are surrounded by all sentient beings. So recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. And to have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. You have to act quickly though, because things are not quite right and they don't exist as they seem to. Nevertheless, you do have a spiritual guide who is leading you towards the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones, the Buddha, the Dharma, and his teachings, and the community, the Sangha. So to make your offering as purely as possible, see yourself as clear as a deity, holding a vajra and a bell, within a sphere of great bliss. Then join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And imagine from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings. And negative karmas and obstructions are purified. And your health and lifespan and virtues and realizations are increased. So cleansed by love and compassion and empowered with wisdom, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts and desire to develop these yourself and to establish all beings into the four immeasurable states. And join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. These dissolve into yourself and all living beings. The negative karmas and obstructions are purified. And your health and lifespan, your virtues and Dharma realizations are increased. On the next exhalation, relax a little more. And from that state of relaxed awareness, imagine the field for accumulating merit appears. And in front of them, you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to protect ourselves from clinging to the pure state and the merit that we've created, we imagine that our body, speech, and mind, and all virtues are transformed into a mandala, a complete world system that we offer to the Buddha and his entourage. And so, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirred with flowers, adorned with Mary, four continents, the sun, and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering, and all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Anda Kamayatrayam. Offering has been released and the Buddha accepts it with a smile. And you meet his smiling gaze, looking up into his face. And looking into the face of the Buddha, you recollect renunciation, wish to give up suffering and its causes. Bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, which seeks enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, in the correct view that all phenomena are empty and dependently arise. We let the Buddha know that we aspire to be just like him. Induced by our wishes and prayers, there emerges from the Buddha, a second figure who absorbs into you, whereby your form clearly becomes that of the Guru Buddha. You radiate from the hum syllable at your heart. Light rays strike all sentient beings surrounding you and place them in the state of the Guru Buddha. You and all sentient beings, each visualized as a Buddha, have at their hearts a moon disc upon which is a white syllable marked with a yellow hum. It's encircled by the mantra of the Buddha. And you begin to recite this. Tayata Om Muni Mahamuneswa. Tayata Om Muni Mahamuneswa. The two purposes are now achieved. Your own enlightenment has come to fruition and you've helped all beings attain the same state. Indeed, by this virtue, may you quickly achieve the state of Guru Buddha Shakyamuni and place all sentient beings without exception into that very same state. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open. But today we're doing this review on this course called Death and Rebirth, isn't it? And so these are some of the materials that I've been using. There's some materials going to come up called the 8 states of clinging to those things that are found to be desirable, which is number 4. So that's about aversion and attachment. And so these books, this material is very good about this. This is in this book here by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, up the corner there, How to Practice Dharma. And there's also another section in one of the Dalai Lama's books on the far side here called Science and Philosophy. I mean, this topic is called the 8 Worldly Concerns. Actually, very good material in there. And the rest of the material is seen in the other books. So what we'll review today is impermanence and worldly concern, recollecting and forgetting death, the 9 reasons meditation, 5 forces of death, dying and death, karma and rebirth, realms of rebirth, and helping to die. So there's a lot there, isn't it? It's like everything we've gone through in the last 8 weeks. But we'll see how we go. Since you've seen a lot of it already, so there's sections in here we will pause, and if you need to ask questions, please do. So the first question we need to ask is, what's the purpose of life? And basically there are 2 ways of looking at this. One is life has an intrinsic meaning, and the other is that we give life meaning. If we think life has an intrinsic meaning, it's a good idea then to search for it and see if you can actually find such an intrinsic meaning. One way that can help you discover whether it does have intrinsic meaning or not is to ask yourself, what would be the consequences if life were to have an intrinsic meaning? One is that we'd all have the same meaning to life. And I'd suggest that we don't. Many of us might not even have a meaning to life. You walk out there and ask people on the street, what's the meaning of life? They go, I don't know. And you go, so it doesn't have, life doesn't have intrinsic meaning. If it did have, you'd know it, and so would I. That only leaves the second option. The meaning of life is the meaning we give it. So you need to work out what sort of meaning you want to give to life. The purpose and meaning, as I've said, are not intrinsic to life. The purpose and meaning are created by us. As you'll see in these teachings of the Mahayana Buddha, the purpose and meaning of our life is to attain enlightenment to benefit others, to do this, to bring them to the same state as ourselves. That's the purpose and meaning of life from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective. Now, one of the characteristics of life is that it's impermanent, that meaning that it changes from moment to moment, and we don't always remain alive. And impermanence can be talked about in 2 ways. One is called coarse impermanence, which is mainly signified by death itself, or the sudden breakage of things and the disappearance of them that we can obviously see with our own eyes and our sight. The other is called subtle impermanence, which you come about through reasoning. So coarse impermanence means impermanence or change in terms of a continuum. So this is the face of a person who's died, and they've been hurriedly covered over with dirt. So what will stop there is the continuum of this life. It's brought about by the death, the experience of this life. This will happen to all of us. So we don't remain like after death, in other words. It's usually just into subtle impermanence, and this is where we have to, through analysis, accept that we're actually changing every moment. So this, we've all changed since we were born, haven't we? If we live another 10 years, we'll have changed again. And so it's been going on and on and on, most of the time without our awareness. So here, subtle impermanence refers to not enduring for a second moment beyond the time of its occurrence. So you sort of think of this is pretty mind-blowing, I would suggest. This means momentariness. The understanding of this type of impermanence really undermines the root of our problems, which is the grasping at inherent existence. Because inherent existence appears as permanence. So we don't often think that we're going to die, but we think we're going to stay the same. And most of us, if we look at our lives, it seems we are still the same. I often think I'm still the same as I was at 19. And you guys might have a similar type feeling about who you are and how you exist. And this knowledge of subtle impermanence will help you reduce attachment and aversion. When you know that your own mind is changing all the time, and all the phenomena around you are also changing, like, all the time, it doesn't make much sense to overestimate things and really want to possess them, does it? And also, it doesn't make much sense to have a long aversion towards different things, because, you know, like, I'm going to go out of existence. So I remember when I was a young boy selling newspapers, and I used to read the stories about what was happening in Uganda with Idi Amin, you know. It used to quite upset me, and that nothing was ever being done about it. And, you know, I used to be thinking, why don't they kill him? Why doesn't somebody just kill him? Now, of course, it never happened. And then years and years later, of course, I came to the borders and was like, don't need to think like that. You'll die. So I don't need to get upset about these, yeah, that he's this person doing these things, killing people and so forth. He'll come to him, he'll die in the end. And so are the other people who behave very badly at this present time. You don't need to hate them. In fact, hate would be going too far. You know, it'd be like an overestimation of their negative qualities. So this is a quote from Swami Sagara Lama. He says, understanding subtle impermanence prepares the mind for insight into selflessness, which is a direct antidote to ignorance. Now, it's like I said before, when you think of that, the phenomena don't exist for a second moment. And yet, look at us, we all seem to be existing much longer than that, don't we? We all seem to be here quite stable, nothing changed. But even the idea that there's a thing, and then it turns into another thing, it's not even like that. It's the thing itself. It comes to its own end. It has the seeds of its own destruction in its arising.
I think it's like very easy to think about how things have causes. Like a cake, for example, you've got a cake, there's causes, we've got the cake. But while the cake is sitting there, like, I have to work really hard to remember actually that cake is decaying moment by moment, even though it looks like it's not. And whereas I tend to, like, it's very easy to think, oh, then we cut it up and then now we've got slices of cake. But actually, even before we're cutting up, it was already changing.
Yeah, so this is how this is for everything. But sometimes if you go on YouTube, you'll be able to see, sometimes they have these little films up there, they're sort of like quick motion things. So what they'll often do is you can watch a flower grow up and then disappear. They come into existence and they go out. What they've done is they just put cameras on it and they've filmed it over a long period of time of its life cycle, and they just sped it up to show you the rapid changes that are taking place. And this is the same for us. Now, understanding this subtle impermanence, very useful for recognizing that that's the case. Phenomena cannot have any form of inherent existence, though that often appears to us. And with the appearance of inherent existence comes these, what they call the eight worldly concerns. So we will be concerned about seeking for what's pleasurable, what we find to be profitable, for admiration, praise, and approval, and for success and reputation. Because each of these four phenomena will always appear like stable to us. And we actually know, don't we, that they're not. But you can be famous and then not recognized 10 years later, right? People praise today and hate you tomorrow. You make a fortune, you lose a fortune. And your pleasures just can't be held on to. So to seek these and to be attached to them would be a mistake on our part. We can make use of them. There's nothing wrong with that. This is not to overestimate them or drive your whole life into seeking them and trying to get them. Now, on the other side, what we're concerned about is pain and discomfort and unpleasant things happen. So we try to avoid all that. And of course we do, and so we should, but you don't need to make it be too tight about it. Right? We don't need to sort of create negative mind spaces about these things. So we try to avoid loss and deterioration, aging. We don't like to hear any sort of criticism or blame. We don't like being disparaged. We don't like to think of ourselves as failures. Now, all these phenomena exist. What they're sort of saying is, and this is what we many people are concerned with, it's the thing to remember is, like, how are we approaching these phenomena? Are we bringing attachment and aversion, these mental states, towards them? And these two mental states can, like I said, be overcome by two major things. One is the subtle impermanence, and the other is these phenomena do not exist in the way they appear to us. The phenomena will always appear to us as inherently existent or objectively existent, is what I think is a nice way of putting it. They seem to have their own existence apart from us, but they don't. That's a false appearance. When we buy into it, we get ourselves into trouble. So in relationship to these eight worldly concerns, Nagarjuna said, "You who know the world, take gain and loss, or bliss and pain, or kind words and abuse, or praise and blame, these eight mundane concerns, make them the same. Don't disturb your mind." What do you mean by make them the same? That they are all impermanent. They do not have any state of their own to stand up in. They depend upon other phenomena. Yet they're stuck. I remember seeing something on YouTube where they were asking these young girls what they wanted to be when they grew up. And all of them say, famous. I want to be famous. Oh, you poor dears, you don't know about the suffering that comes with being famous. this is what this guy ain't really concerned is getting at. It's like you're sick, there's something like out there that if you just get that, you'll be right. Yeah, so that's what they're saying. Like this is what this thing is getting, make them all the same.
Yes.
And so sometimes, you know, there's other antidotes to each one of these, of course, but the major antidote which makes them the same is this recognition that they're all subject to change, and none of them have the existence that they seem to have. Another term for this existence is called true existence, which means that the phenomena exist in the way you're apprehending them. In other words, the way that you see them with your own mind and your ideas, that's the way they exist. They don't. And this is why you see these poor young girls saying, "I want to be famous." You go, "Yeah, it's not like it looks to you." Yeah, so the fact, Sandy, it takes a long time for the eight worldly concerns to lose their power over us. A long time. In fact, it takes them really the realization of emptiness to do it. But then you can see through it. But this fellow don't have their own owners. They're interdependent and impermanent. Is there anything else anybody else would like to say about what we just covered? Okay, so here we've looked at impermanence, gross and subtle. So gross is such that is really about death itself. So this is kind of from a Buddhist perspective. So we've got our death, and there's subtle impermanence, things not existing for the second moment beyond the time of their occurrence. And then so that's the way it is. Then we have these eight worldly concerns. And this is also the way it is, but they're telling us so that we can understand them better, to understand, look, they don't exist in the way they appear to you. But to have aversion or attachment to them is not a wise idea. I mean, aversion or attachment is basically beyond our control at the moment. Right? We just naturally feel that way. Some things are really great and some things are just terrible. It looks that way, feels that way. And things saying, yeah, that's I know it's like that, but don't go along with your feelings here. These things don't exist in the way they appear to you. You need to challenge your appearance. Now, what we just talked about is eight worldly concerns. They're the major hindrances to us developing an authentic spiritual path. And if you look around you, most people's lives are concerned with those eight worldly concerns. So it's not the fact that we don't need wealth, or it's just like emphasizing it too much. That's if you have attachment to it. And there's a film I saw many years ago called, I think it was called Romeo Loved Juliet. It was about a corrupt policeman. And it began by, and there's this voiceover, and this policeman is running down the backyard, and he's got his spade, and he's digging it up, and he says, I fell in love with a hole in the ground. I cracked up laughing, so I thought, yeah, so did I. And what is it? He's digging down to get his money. He's stuck in the backyard. And there you go, there's a bloke who's overestimated wealth, just like me. So I sort of like watching, seeing films like that, seeing my own behaviour. Yeah, I was like that. So yeah, these eight worldly concerns will stop you actually engaging authentically in your path. But always, it's hard, it's like Sandy says. You think you're making progress with one, then the other will pop up. So this leads us into the different faults that occur when we overcome by the eight worldly concerns. So does anybody remember what the first fault is in these six faults? It's quite simple, it's a great one. It says, you don't remember the Dharma. And so one of the Dharmas is impermanence. All those eight worldly concerns are impermanent, they're subject to change. They don't have their own reality. Whatever's real about them depends upon your own mind. And so we don't remember the Dharma when we forget about death. Just to say, in the Buddha first taught, his first teaching was about death and impermanence. First Four Noble Truths, said all phenomena are impermanent, subject to change. At the very end, he said the same thing, he said, so struggle on with diligence, bring diligence. We just can't avoid death, death's going to take place. Now, if there's nothing after death, then we really wonder what teachings of the Buddha are all about, right? Well, we just want to have a good life, but it's not. It's like saying, no, there's something else that's going to happen. Because death is also impermanent. Death is also changeable. And so what's going to happen after? That's the question. And if there's something after, what can we do now to prepare for what's after? And the simplest thing, you know, is like, remember the Dharma. So, and Dharma here, it's got many meanings, but one meaning you can take ashore is don't create suffering for yourself or anybody else. And it's basically that's simple. If that's the case, you'll die easy and the next life will be great for you. Yeah, so when we forget death, we forget the Dharma. Even if we do remember the Dharma and we forget death, we don't practice it. Now, I can tell you this is true from my own experience. This is not you just look through your life, if you take up the Dharma, you take refuge, this is what happens to you. It's just one of the things that happens. And here, these texts are just pointing out. I remember the saying from the Dharma to Amram Chedlo. He says, when you just look in the mirror of your own experience, it'll tell you whether you practice Dharma or not. So that's the way, you just keep honest that way. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It's just, your mind's not under control, right? All the time, right? It's hard. You pull away. So we don't remember the Dharma, but if we do remember Dharma, we don't actually practice it. This is because we forget death. And if we do practice, it's not purely, it's for this life, to be happy now. We forget, somehow or other, why we think, I'm going to die and that's it. And of course, then your practice lacks persistence. You don't practice every day. Just, you might practice once a day or when you remember, something like this. And so, of course, when death comes, basically you lose control over everything you've got. Everything's going to go. Your body's going to leave you, basically. In fact, the other day, this flu came over me. I had so much pain going through my body. I was just sort of watching it all and thinking, man, I think this is the suffering of all pervasive conditioning. And it's like, I have no control over this whatsoever. And it's just everything is painful. I move this one, it hurts. You know, that one, it hurts. Just got to lie there really still and just breathe and watch the whole thing. And I go, yeah, this is when they say when your elements are out of control. I said, yeah, well, that's what a flu would do to you. It just throws your whole body system out of whack. Right? And then when you, so I'm lying there and watching, I'm trying to bring Dharma, and it all gets all mixed up in my mind. I'm trying to work with the two truths, I couldn't put it together. I was kind of like, no, that's not right, that's not right. And just flip it across. And, so this is what it's like. And so we prevent our own, this liberation, the state of peace that we've been seeking for ourselves, the state of freedom that we've been looking for so long. It doesn't come about because we keep behaving the same way we've always behaved. But of course, it then come the time of death, we regret what we did not do. We had a chance to do it, we did not do it. Whatever we did, it wasn't sufficient enough, strong enough. This is what I'm trying to say to you, like, try and make it as simple as you can, the Dharma, right? And essentially, just to have a good heart. To try and, you are concerned enough about yourself to not hurt others. You understand, if you're really concerned about yourself, don't hurt other people, because it'll hurt you. The person who's hurt will be you. That's for sure. Whether they're hurt or not, who knows? You will be hurt. And if this works against you, it works against your own wish for happiness and to be free from suffering. And if you can do that, then you can die without regret, can't you? You'll be down there, no, I look back, I have no regrets, I haven't harmed anybody. In fact, I tried to help people as best as I could. Yes, I never realized emptiness or all these things, but that's just true. You die with a good heart, good mind, that has to be in place. All the rest will follow. But that's got to be in place. These are the faults when we forget death. And if there are great benefits when we do recollect death. So the first one is that your actions become very beneficial. So like I said, when you do that, you don't harm other people, right? Because you know you're going to die and you're going to experience the results of the actions you did. That's really beneficial. Then of course your practice becomes very powerful too. And so when you have no cons, the mind becomes more peaceful. You're not hurting others or thinking of with ill will or malice towards anybody or have a great aversion or attachment. Then you actually have a workable basis, a good mind to work with. And recollecting death at the beginning of the practice is always important. It purifies the practice. You know you're not practicing just for this life. The goodness of Dharma practice will come to you in this life. But if it's just for this life, it teaches you to stop Dharma practice. Not the practice of Dharma. So, what's the result of practicing this for this life? He said, the benefits come to you in this life. He said, what happens afterwards? He goes, hell. The lower realms. But you weren't practicing beyond this life, you're just practicing for this life, so you get the results of just this life. It'll carry you through all your practices, and of course, it's very important at the end because you die content, you die without regret. So this is also true. This next slide, I discovered this myself. And so death recollection stops the delusions. So most of you know that when, well, at least when you get unwell, it's easy to be cranky. At least I find it quite easy to be cranky, get sort of short-tempered. And then so, like the other day, so then Miffy will say something like, "Have you taken your medicine? Did you do this?" And it's like, "I just leave me alone." And but I'm going, I can't even answer. I thought, yeah, that's good because you don't want to answer poorly. I said, yeah, that's what it does. It stops you saying the wrong thing. Like, can you imagine if you knew, like, within a minute or so you're going to die, and somebody like carried on at you? Would you really want to go on blah blah blah? It's like I read a story that was one of the stories in the Lamb Room, one of the Buddha stories, where there are six people in the cell and they're all going to be executed. And that's the outcome. And they start arguing amongst themselves. And this is that. So why would you do that? That's really stupid. I'm not going to imagine it happening. That's how people are, aren't they? But why? What's the point? Like, within a minute or so, we're all going to be living out there to have our necks chopped off. And what, we want to spend the last few moments of our lives bickering with each other? Doesn't make much sense. And that's what delusions are, they don't make much sense. So the thought of death and these delusions that we have, they just come to an end. Now, especially with a bit of background in the Dharma, often when you get upset, you ask yourself, who's being upset? Well, I am. Okay, so how does this I exist that's upset? You ask those sort of questions, you find that the I that's upset actually doesn't exist at all. But you're acting as if it does. And it's the same with these words. Well, are these words actually spoken amongst us? Aren't they just syllables put together, a thing called words, supported by air, moving across space, going to our ear, and then we go, that means, and then we all get upset. So in my mind, one of the mental things I do, so just imagine if you're in a cell with six people, and they all spoke a different language, and they all started swearing at one another in their language. I mean, would you get upset? You probably wouldn't have, because you wouldn't know what they were saying. it's not the words that have the power, it's the meaning you put to them. And so, like, meaning, you go, okay, well, the meaning of this is like, I don't want to put that sort of meaning to this, because in a moment or two, we're going to be dead, right? So let's just put that aside. So then this thing is, one of the questions I had to answer is, what do you say to a 16-year-old who's heavily involved in just having fun? Like, convince me that's important to me, to meditate on death. So I've been thinking about this, and like, oh, I couldn't come up with anything. Right? And then, fortunately for me, I picked it, this funny thing, I think about the stuff, I pull about a book and open it up, and there's the answer. And this answer comes from a Buddhist nun. There's Thupten Chodron and what's the other Chodron?
Pema
Chodron. Pema Chodron, yeah. So Pema Chodron's a nun, sorry, you would have probably heard of it. So before she became a nun, of course, she had children. And she brought one of her children to this great master and said, could you just say something that might be meaningful? And I think, this is what he said. You are going to die. And when you die, you'll take nothing with you but your state of mind. Oh, that was outrageous. Hey, you're right. That's what they do, these guys. I'll just tell you the truth, just straight up. And so people tell me, of course, like, she's a nun, she's like, fine with that. But like, imagine yourself, if you were there as a young person, you meet this guy, expect, what's he going to say? And then he says that to you, you are going to die. When you die, nothing will help you but your state of mind. You'll take nothing with you but your state of mind. And so just like he said that to this child, I mean, that's what we should take to us. We are ourselves, right? They'll say, when I was lying here so sick yesterday, like, the mind is still there. I mean, the body hurts like heck. There's all the stuff going on here inside there, and I can't get any sort of control over it. So all I'm trying to just be present, relax, don't grasp at anything. You know? And it might be the same same for us. In fact, I often say, you know how good your practice is at the time of death. Other times I say, you can know how good your practice is whenever you meet a difficulty. That's how well you practice, when you meet difficulties. Again, from Padmasambhava, he says, the vision of this life is like last night's dream. And all meaningless actions are like ripples on the lake. Yes, so we're awake right now, where this all looks real to us, and like tomorrow, it's all gone. It'll like something like it will come back, like the sun will rise, the light will be there. It'll look like just another day. Like just like I had my sort of senses of delirium a couple of days ago, it's gone. That's it. So are all the appearances of this life. We're just going to go. And many, if you've read biographies of people and the last words I say on their deathbed, many times it's like it all went by so quickly. You know, people look like, what did it mean? What did we do with this life? I remember one that really struck me was Ava Gardner. So I really loved Ava Gardner when I was a boy. You know? She's such a beautiful woman on the screen. And her last words when she died were, I am so tired. Oh yeah, okay, so this beautiful woman with all this money and fame with it, and it was just like, yeah. It's like she's had enough of it. I thought, well, that's not the way I want to die. So when you come to like become familiar with our own, with that dying and death, there's a way of doing it. It's called the nine reasons death meditation. So I'll put up three slides. So what you've got on each of them is you have the first thing to say, so like, look, death is certain. Then you sort of think about it. So has anybody ever avoided death? Yet? Or no. So I won't be able to avoid it. Can I sort of really extend my life for another 100 years or so? No. Yeah, so you end up with this thing that death is certain. Okay. So what does that mean? Yeah, so for many people it'll mean, Jesus, enjoy yourself now. There's nothing else, right? But from a Buddhist perspective, they would say, so you've got these three sort of reasons. My life, the Lord of Death, in other words, death itself, I personified it as, you know, the phenomena has power over everything that lives, called death. Your lifetime can't be extended. In fact, as soon as you are born, it starts to diminish. This is because of subtle impermanence. And while you are alive, there is little time to practice. This is true. Anyone who's practicing Dharma knows how pressed you are for time. But you have to practice Dharma because death is certain. There's no avoidance of death. Now the second fact here is that the time of death is uncertain. So there are people who know when they're going to die and they die just then, but it's a rare thing, and it often takes a great deal of practice to be able to do it. So for most of us, the time of our death is uncertain. And this is because the lifespan in the world that we live in is uncertain. You know, you can die in the womb. You can die just after being born. You could die, they call it still cot death. You know, you can die in the kitchen as you got into the kitchen drawer when you shouldn't have, and there was mum's cleaners there and you drank it. There's so many ways you can die. And so it's not like the science fiction movies where everybody dies at 35 or something, right? No, you can die at the very beginning of life or live into your 90s and you'll die. And that's like I said, because the lifespan is uncertain. Not only that, but the causes of death are very, very many. While those that support life are very few. It's interesting, this material thing, see you thinking, this is good, you need to think about this. And go, is this true what they're saying? What Eddie's put up on the slide there, put up there, like think about it. Because if you can go, yes, that's true, then the practice of Dharma becomes easy. But we're just working in accordance with the facts of life. It's like this is what I need to do then. And it's true, this body's really fragile. So my dad died weeding the garden. And he didn't even know that this bacteria went up into his foot. And then in about 3 days he was dead. he got his whole leg poisoned. We got the doctors in. They went, no, we can't do anything for you, Mr. Pete. And 3 days later, he was dead. Yes, it was very, very fragile. You could die, you've got a pin and just push it into your heart and be dead. So many ways you can die.
And I guess that could also work another way, where often doctors would say, oh, you've got this terrible illness, you've only got X amount of months or weeks to live. And then some people surpass that. So if you don't really use that life well and you kind of spent it really sad, then you're going to pass away. And then you had more time. It's like, oh, I wasted that time as well.
Yeah, well, people do that too, don't they? They don't know about Dharma, don't know what to do. Yeah, some of us don't know what to do with this life we have when we're not on our deathbed. We go to the doctors, we're given a reprieve, and what do? Well, I hope most people will repair their relationships with their families and things like that. At least try and do some good before you go. The time of death is uncertain because it's uncertain, but practice Dharma now. And so the practice of Dharma is mainly mental work. So we know that the causes of suffering are two. There's the delusions, the disturbing emotions, and the second thing is karma. Now karma is intention. So if you wake up every day, every morning, and bring a good intention to your life, that's the karma taken care of. And if you understand, by now I don't let my affections get the better of me, and you go, well, that means I must not hurt anybody. So I hurt someone, I hurt me. So it can be quite simple. And you've just got to remember it and try and integrate it into your life. So this is why you'll see most of the time, like whenever we start off with a motivation. But that's the karma part. You need to take care of that, get good karma in place. You know, build good habits. Those good experiences that'll lead to a good rebirth. Now, only Dharma practice helps at the time of death. So I'll put this one in here, as you might be able to see a lot of naked people in there. And it's like having a good time at the party, right? But like I said, all those crumbles and the bones and the ashes, but there's nothing left of it. So your friends can't help. They'll try to, but their help is minimal. Their friends can't stop it. Everything you've accumulated is no use to you now. Anything physical, it's over. And the only thing that really will help you now is how you can think. And how you can think is really dependent on how you have thought. And so if you think well now, and you keep it up, it'll be easy. You sit down there, a nurse comes over, and you'll be sort of thinking, oh, how wonderful that these nurses are here to help me. Then you have a really good outlook towards people. You always want to be looking at the good side and not the negative side. And again, of course, your body doesn't help. This is where your body lets you down. It's doing its own thing, right? Yeah, so here you mean the practice of Dharma I do must be pure. This is why it's aimed at a future life, right? This life will come to an end. Whatever I've done in this life, I want to carry across to the other life. And again, if you sort of sit there thinking, I really don't know if there is another life or not. So you go, okay, that's right. We don't actually know for certain. Right? All we have is the experiences of the Buddha. If you go online, you'll see many stories of people who have died and things have happened. If you look at yourself and say, but yeah, I don't know. Okay, so I thought about this. So when you say, I don't know, so I'm going to do nothing, what does that tell yourself? What are you saying?
Nothing matters.
Nothing matters. Yeah, I don't believe what? What do you guys think? What would you say? because I don't know, because I don't know what happens, if there's anything that happens after death, I'm not really considered practicing the Dharma, or when I practice Dharma.
Better to have the insurance than not
have
the insurance.
Yeah, well, this is right, sure. So when you say, I don't know, so I'm going to do this, what you're saying actually is, I have this idea that nothing's going to happen. I'm kind of like, I know nothing's going to happen, so I'm not going to do anything. But you don't know that. You've got to go, I don't know. You don't know whether it's nothing or whether it's something. But if you err on the side of nothing and there is something, now what? It's too late, isn't it? So you're just going to have to go along with what happens. It's out of your hands. But if you've prepared for it and there's nothing, you're fine because there's nothing. No harm done. But if there's something, so come on, if there is something, you're ready. So in the story, so Cheryl, just what you said, this question was posed to a great French mathematician and logician. And he raised the question, does God exist? Because he was a Christian, right? And thinker. And he came up with the same thing. I don't know. There's no way I can say for certain God does exist or not. And being a logician thought then the smart move is behave as if he did exist. If he doesn't, nothing lost. But if he does, oh boy, I'm ready. And so he gave up the maths and all that stuff and entered the priesthood. Spent the rest of his life as a priest. And when I read that, I thought, now that's the attitude to take towards. You can ask the same question about, is there life after death or nothing? Is something after or nothing? You come to the same idea and go, I don't actually know. But I'll take some insurance. Because I don't know.
Getting the odds in your favor.
Yeah, that's right. And if there's, that's right. Like I said, really, if there is nothing, it's like, I remember Robert Derman said to so is anybody here, are the people here afraid of dying? So of course a lot of people put their hands up. He said, so, I'm not sure if he phrased it this way, he said, so if there's, when you're dead and there's nothing, who is afraid of that? And all these people put their hands up. And I thought, wow, it just shows you how you don't understand the consequences of your thinking. If there's nothing, you won't be there. How can you be afraid of nothing?
And also, if you don't know what's going to happen after death and you kind of go, so I'm not going to do nothing, it's almost like I don't know how to solve the problem, so I'm just going to ignore the problem and hope it goes
right.
Away.
Yeah, that's right. Just like this thing. The idea of all this is not to be afraid of death. That's the point. You don't want to be scared of death. There's nothing you can, it's going to happen, right? So being afraid of it is pointless. What to be afraid of is what might happen after. That's what we need to be afraid of. And then go, then I'm going to get ready. So I don't need to be afraid. But often says what they say, be scared now so that you're not scared later. So they call this mindfulness. What is it that I need to remember then? They say, don't create causes for the sufferings of a lower rebirth. But look, just what I was saying before, the way you create causes for these lower rebirths is by hurting people, then you hurt yourself. Now you've got a cause for suffering by the end of it. If you don't do that, you can't experience these terrible states after death. So, you know, when you look at the Buddhist practice, how it's done, the first thing they say is, just stop doing these things. They ask you just to restrain yourself. Don't kill any humans. Don't steal things from people. Don't engage in sexual misconduct. Right, it's just restraint. Because if you do restrain yourself, you won't put a pause for these negative outcomes after death. And in that freedom that comes from the strength, they are putting these positive qualities. like I said, of killing people, I try to save and help them as much as I can. Instead of stealing, be generous. Instead of engaging in sexual misconduct, try to heal relationships. You know, instead of lying, tell the truth. This is an abandoned lying, right? So, you know, lies, you just stop doing it. This is now try to speak the truth. And you also know there's times when you don't want to speak the truth, right? Because it hurts the person too much. You gotta go like, how do I do that? So all this material's in the text, you can find out and talk about it and that sort of thing. The major thing is like, you know, don't restrain yourself from harming yourself. And the major way we harm ourselves is there's only three ways: body, speech, and mind. And most of us don't harm ourselves physically. And like I said, it all comes from the mind, you know, the mind leads it all. So at the time of death, we can bring to it like it's intention. That's what I'm saying, this karma. Right? I'm saying it's so important. So each day when you wake up, say, what's the point of my life? What's the purpose? And today, I'm going to do the very best I can to create greater compassion, greater wisdom, a greater sense of community, whatever. You've got to find the words that sit right with you. When you go to the text, you'll see a lot of material. Lovers Open is famous for this. Pages of intention. So I can't do too much, like I just get all tired and go like, oh man, following on life. Well, then you try and bring it down to the essential point. So you can say, you know, if you had a child and said, mummy, what's the purpose of life? You can just go, you just tell them, this is the purpose I have for my life. And you try and make it really simple. And remember that this life will come to an end. So life is like life after life after life. The purpose has to carry you through from life to life to life. It's got to be reasonable to you and firm in your own mind. So you remind yourself of your intention again. I'm going to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. And at the time of death, what do I need to be familiar with there? So the death position. The way I lie in my bed as I'm dying. Will I be sitting up or will I be lying down? Because people don't often die in other ways. I read of one guy, highly realized guy, he said to his sister, so in what ways have people not ever died? And I was thinking about it, she said, oh, some standing on their head. Okay, well, that's what he did. And she came in and she said, stop showing off. And he said, book. It collapsed. and here's like, you know, you look at your bed, you find that there's, you know, stuff in the text here. This line, I think it's on your left, no, right side, I think it is. Block your right nostril. And that'll stop the breathing in that way, which are the winds and support. Thoughts of anger. And so that's why I block it off, because every disturbing emotion you have, and even positive emotions, they have energy with them. Right? So to stop the negative ones, you block that nostril off so you don't breathe in through that nostril. Yeah, that's from the Tantra teachings. White seed is virtue again. You know, it's like a sort of thing, okay, I'll come to the end of my life. I think I've led a good life. Remind yourself of why you do it and why when this death comes, you're going to do it again. Now, one of the things I've often thought is like, I'll at least be able to show the nurses how to die. I'll show the nurse how a person who's practiced spiritually dies. Right? Give them something good to take home. And like the revulsion means like, don't let your negative mental states rear up now, right? At the very end of your life, don't be cranky. But calm down. And again, it's like why? To fulfill your wish, this aspiration, right? I'm leaving this life. I'm going to come back somewhere. And wherever I come back, I want to be a benefit to those beings. So anything interesting here, folks? I mean, you see, they give different instructions for, so sometimes the practice switches over to the other side if you're doing that sort of practice.
with the nine round or just lying?
No, this is not nine round breathing. Yeah, so I think it's in the Vajrayogini practice they do, you switch over the nostril. But yeah, so it depends. If you're doing high ashtanga tantric practices, there's changes in the nostril. But if you're just an ordinary person, it's like normally the airs go up to these nostrils, they come down the central channel, they go out to the chakras, and you know, if you try and get some control over that. Okay, so let's do a meditation, folks. But please just get comfortable in your seat, just adjust. Let your body breathe itself. And let your breath find its natural rhythm. And as you breathe, recognize the very preciousness of this very moment. In this moment that you're breathing naturally, that moment's gone. The very next moment is gone. Yet we're still here breathing. So the breath itself is noticeable. You'll notice it's not the same breath, it changes. This is really the gross sense of change. So things are coming into existence and going out of existence. We want this meditation to benefit ourselves and all beings who face the certainty of death, not knowing the time of death. So we began by looking at meaning. So meaning is either intrinsic or constructed. If meaning were intrinsic, there are consequences that don't make sense. So the conclusion is, meaning is constructed. We make it up. So what meaning do you want to give to this life? So remember, this life will come to an end. Does the meaning that you've given this life continue on through any other life? Would it be the same sort of thing you want to do with your life? Now, whatever meaning or purpose you've given to this life, not a moment of this life endures beyond the second moment of its occurrence. And every appearance of this life is like last night's dream. And when the continuum of this life ends in what we call death, we take nothing with us but the occurring state of a disintegrating mental moment. So what will that mental moment, what meaning have you given that mental moment? And if you do not remember your death, will you be able to hold on to that meaning? Will you remember the meaning and purpose of your life? So we looked at the different faults of forgetting death, Try to remember a few of them. Probably the greatest fault of forgetting death is to die with regret. You will have no regret if your purpose is still clear in your mind and the purpose goes beyond this life. There are great many advantages to have a great purpose for this life and to recollect the certainty of death. At the time of death, we have the five forces. Can you recollect those five forces? The most important being the very first one, which was intention. Intention is karma. Then the second force is the force of familiarity. At the time of death, it's related with the posture. Then there's the white seed. This is a virtuous mind, and here it's really focused upon the act of generosity. You've given away all your belongings. The fourth power of the white seed is called repudiation. Now, what are you repudiating? Pushing away the negative mental states. You want to have as little to do as possible with self-grasping, self-cherishing, and every other negative mental state. And finally, there's the power of familiarity. So again, this comes back to our original motivation. You are familiar with your purpose. It's going to take you through this life and every other life. So you ask, does my purpose do this? If it doesn't, then over time alter your purpose so it becomes large enough to accompany every lifespan. Okay, now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. Get your eyes open. So now we're going to sort of look at what happens just before we die, and then the stages of death itself. So the rebirth occurs through a causal continuity without a permanent identity. And so we know that we're not permanent, are we? We change. And how we actually exist is just as a name imputed to other changing phenomena. Another changing phenomenon is mind. So our sense of I or our identity goes along with each moment. The person you've identified in this life, perhaps it's Sandy or Eddie, that identity comes to an end in this life. That comes to the end of death. People will no longer talk to us as Sandy or Eddie, right? And we won't even think of ourselves as that person. But that concept will have fallen away. But there'll still be a sense of I, just without that extra added bit, the name. So some of the things that come into real importance at the time of death are what's called craving and clinging, and karma and becoming. So these are links 8, 9, and 10 in the terms of the 12 links of interdependent origination. They also have a related consciousness and birth, aging, name, and feeling. So all of these are links in the chain of interdependence. For example, so this time we've got a person called Patricia. And during her work during the day, so Patricia's a volunteer and she goes to the hospital. And when she works around people, everybody likes her. She makes them feel good. And she deliberately does this. Right? So because it's a definite act on her part, she intends to do this. This places on her mind what they call the karmic seeds, right? These propensities. This is the same thing I'm suggesting we all do. Let's try and be a real good person in ordinary life, deliberately. Right? Because it fulfills your purpose. Whatever purpose you've got, you acting well towards others fulfills your purpose. So that when death finally arrives and this craving and clinging come into place, right, they're going to cling on, they're going to grab at the seed, number 10. If you can remember the wheel of interdependent origination, I think it's on link 2. That's where the karma is. So we create our acts there. So it's been like Pat here. She's at the hospital. She creates these good acts. Soon as she finishes them, they're on the line stream. At the time of her death, she wants to awaken. Not right now, so it's going to lead into a link 10 becoming the new life. So you want to have your virtue lead you into your new life, not your fears and not your regrets. That's what I'm saying. This is actually important to try and create as many positive ideas and mind spaces as you can and act on them. So it's natural, right? Just as natural at the time of death. Let me just go quickly, leave that alone, because this is like a huge, this is a couple of day teaching. Just to let you know, that at the time of death, these, the craving and the clinging will come up on your mind stream. And what you want it to do is to activate a virtuous karma. Because it could activate a non-virtuous karma, and that's what you don't want. You can't stop the craving and clinging unless you've realized emptiness and done it that way. If you haven't, you have to admit, okay, my mind's going to, look, you know, it's going to be grasping at things. I want to grasp at the good stuff I've done. So as we're lying on the bed or wherever we are, what they call the elements begin to dissolve or collapse. So that the earth element is referring basically to your body and everything physical and solid. It becomes weaker, and inside while you're lying, it's like a mirage. Things are sort of wavery. Then your liquids start to dry up. So you won't be able to drink very much, and oftentimes you'll find either the caregiver or the nurse will be putting water just on your lips because it's dried up. So inside it becomes a vision, it's like a smoky appearance. And you can sort of go backwards and forwards here. I remember when Inter was dying, this is what happened, you know. Sometimes you think there's a whole lot of water in the room. You chance we start giggling, you go, that's the water appearance, you know. So then it's, oh, yeah, great. Now that you've done it, now we know too, you know. Then you get really cold. So the, in other words, the energies called fire here. They go down. So I noticed this myself over the last couple of days. Like, I was really cold. Right? It's been quite warm here. And then the energies themselves are absorbed also. And there's like a flickering sort of light. And at the end of that, the doctors will pronounce you dead. But from a Buddhist perspective, you're not. Consciousness is still within the body. Now, the consciousness is going to have not just these experiences of mirage, smoke, fireflies, and flickering. That was all taking place as the major components of the body withdrew, collapsed. Now, the mind itself is going to experience these phenomena. The vivid white appearance, it's called the empty, the vivid red appearance, the vivid black near attainment and the clear line of death. And at this one, the number 8, that's when you're actually dead. Now, some people who've practiced a lot, especially wisdom realizing emptiness, and they become familiar with that, they can stand the clear line of death for a long time and the body doesn't decompose. A normal body will decompose pretty quickly as soon as the consciousness leaves down here. But within 3 or 4 days of that, and they did. When Inta died, it was obvious to us that her consciousness was still there. But up between the third and fourth day, it became obvious it wasn't. And so if you ever sat with a dead person, the person who's died, many times it's like they're still there. You know, but then it's also a phase where you go, they're not. That's also obvious. So for very good spiritual practices within the Buddhist tradition, it's incredibly important at this time here. This is where they do major amounts of practice in the clear light of death. And of course, in there, it's all deity practice, what they train themselves in, Ayurveda Tantra and so forth. And at that stage, like I said, in terms of about 3 to 4 days, what often happens is, with her, at least, is this little drop of blood comes out of the nostril. So consciousness leaves this, what they call a heart center. It's not the actual physical heart, it's another type of heart. It's an analogy, metaphor. You die, and then the intermediate stage begins. The intermediate stage is like, so now your consciousness is left, and now it's going to be seeking the new body it's to inhabit. And that's often seen to be quite it depends like how you've lived your life, right? If you lived your life harming a lot of people, being bad, so people behave badly, it's going to be a very freaky, terrible experience for you. If you've lived a really good life, and especially if you've died with this mind eventually, your intention is to do something, the intention will drive you through this thing, and you have appearances that suit your intention. This is all mind. It'll look like it's not. Just like if you look around you, like this all doesn't appear to you to be an appearance of mind, does it? Mm. And so it's just like that. It's just like it's as real as this looks to us. And in here, so it's the mind itself that creates both the fear and the freedom. It's always the mind. Then it can take you to the lower realms or the upper realms. And so these are both realms within samsara. So this is where we probably find ourselves reborn back into the desire realm. So I say that because, well, I'm just guessing, but unless you've developed really deep stages of meditation, primarily karma-binding meditation, you cannot take rebirth in the form or formless realm. You don't have the karma to do it. So in these other realms, form realms and formless realms, the major thing there is your concentration developed in this life. So you develop this really strong, stable mind. And at the time of death, you just go straight back onto that. You go back into the mind. You just, right? And then so you open your eyes and you're in this other place. So there's no bardo state to arrive here. So the mind is uncontrolled and you get the bardo state. That's if you can only bring it like it under control, and if you have not realized emptiness, then you end up in the formless realms. And so some, you know, said that some people have done that before, and it mainly comes about because in these states of concentration, it actually feels really good. If you think about it, you go, of course, but there's no afflictions. And the afflictions are lessened. In these realms, you can't have hatred or anger. That's one thing that's finished. But that's only a desire realm mind. You still got attachment, though. And even small things of aversion, because you're sort of going, nah, this realm's not good enough, I want a better one. So you keep doing that while you're in the human body, right? Developing these deeper states of concentration. Like, and you know, wow, there's a completely different realm that I have experienced here. I want to have that again. That's where I want to go when I die. Or I want my life to be like that. And so you do what you've done here, and that's what happens to you. Now, if you take rebirth within the desire realm, this is the sort of birth you can take, what they call the devas. So these are like, seem to be like godly type beings. The Asuras are sort of like that too, but they've got a lot of jealousy and they fight a lot. Then there's the humans, the animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings. So the Asuras and Devas, they have bodies, but they're sort of more like light They're not like heavy like ours. And it's actually what determines whether you're going to be born as any of these beings is the actions we do now. They're the primary ones. Of course, we've done plenty of actions in the past too. They've also put their seeds on our continuum so we can have this result. That's why it's so important to have a good motivation, to have your purpose set every day and be a non-harmful purpose. And is it, you know, when I sort of analyzed this material and thought about it, so many years ago, you know, I thought meaning was intrinsic. So I looked for the intrinsic meaning. I couldn't find one. So I thought life had no meaning. So then I became a nihilist. Then a bloke introduced me to a book called Man's Search for Meaning. So I have a read, see what he's got to say. He said, you give life meaning. I went, oh my God, he's right. Just because I couldn't, just because there's no intrinsic meaning doesn't mean to say there's no meaning. There's meaning if you give it meaning. Okay, now I'm looking for what's the best meaning I can give to my life? And for me, the Dharma provided. Because to become a Buddha for the benefit of others. If you ask them, what does it mean to be a Buddha? You say, I have a compassion that's all extensive, applies to every being. There's none left out. A wisdom that can see things as they are, truth as it is. And then the ability to help them. So they're the three major factors. Is the wisdom, the compassion, and the ability. And then the other side, matter of mind is no beginning. They're just going to go. Even when you become attain that state, it's still mind. It's just that you're a Buddha, and now you can do this thing that you've actually set yourself out to do. So I can't find a better meaning or purpose for life. Well, but that's what I'll take in. Especially, like I said, you make it up. So, as I can think of to make one up, somebody else had. I thank you. Yeah, so it's morning. It's a great one because it'll take you from life to life to life. Right? This is how it is. You always want to be happy. You always want to be wiser. You always want to help yourself and someone else. It says here in brief, and this is from 7.9 training. It says in brief, the essence of the instruction is to train in the five forces or the five powers. The five powers themselves are the great vehicle's precept on the transference of consciousness. Cultivate these paths of practice. So the bottom part here that we just did in black there, that's what we covered before, the five powers at death. And so there are means to train, what they say, you know, how to transfer your consciousness from this life to another life. The simplest and most effective is the five powers. And I suggest the reason for that is because you've been doing it all your life. It's not something you need to create newly at the time of death, when your mind's already weakened and your body's weak. Other people are taught methods where you can actually eject consciousness out into a visualized deity and the pure land. There's a number of different practices you can do. But if you've never done it before, at the time of death is not the time to try and do it. So you just did an initiation a couple of days ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, a power practice. So you can learn these techniques. But like I said, even so, when Inter had with his mother, she had high show the tantric initiation, she was going to do those practices, and Lama Zopa said, no, do this practice. And Lama Yeshu died. Now he was a Mahamudra practitioner, a high yoga practitioner. What did he do? The five powers. Like I said, the major result of this is the simplicity of it. And that if you look at them, we've been doing them all the time. So we do these five powers during life as well. So like I said, you start with your motivation. Each day you get up in the morning, you reaffirm the purpose. So come to die, you just reaffirm the purpose. It's not something new, it's easy. It's a habit of yours. You are familiar with it. It is a virtuous mind, that's the root of the white seed. You do know what harms you, self-cherishing, self-grasping, and all the other disturbing emotions that go along with it, so you reject them. And then you dedicate this life to your future goal. Like, you know, so that here we start off with the motivation. We're going to finish off with the dedication, so we do it every day in these classes. In fact, they say the two most important things of any practice you do is those two. Not the practice itself, the motivation and the dedication. They're the most important things. And like I said, so then we aspire to achieve our goal. Of course, this will always be very difficult for you if you think that, you know, if you still haven't resolved that, man, perhaps consciousness does go on, like, forever. Now, when you're sitting with somebody else or you yourself are dying, this is what you want to do, right? Encourage rejoicing and kindness. So rejoice in your own efforts to be a good human being. But a lot of people forget this. Many, many people are very familiar with pulling themselves down, finding their own faults. But this is not, dying is not the time to do that, right? Don't do that. So be kind to yourself. There might not be anybody around you, but you can exert kindness towards the nurses. So always do that. So recollect something virtuous. This is what you need to do yourself and encourage anybody else to do. If you're sitting with somebody who's not a Buddhist, encourage them to draw upon their spiritual objects. If it's Christ or Mary, whatever, no matter, encourage them to do it. But because that object is an object of virtue. As soon as their mind gets up, man, I've got a virtuous mind, yeah, great, done it. That'll help them. And especially don't do this. If you're really sad or upset, go leave the room. Go outside and cry. Don't make yourself the center of attention when you've got a person who's dying. There is the same with Miffy's mum, it's your party. And it is, it's the dying person's party. We're the guests. We don't have badly at somebody else's party. Okay, we'll do this last meditation. That'll be it. So please again, get comfortable in your seat. Let your body breathe itself. So imagine that you can generate a really powerful purpose for your life. If you could, what would this powerful purpose be? And imagine what it would feel like if every breath you took was an action that brought you closer to your purpose. So using the five forces, see if you can fit your purpose into these five purposes, these five forces. We begin with a force of motivation or intention. So you need to bring that up first. What would you do to become familiar with this motivation? Is your motivation like a white seed? Is it virtuous, bringing greater happiness and benefit to yourself and others? So what would get in the road? What would be an obstacle to you achieving your purpose? Whatever obstacles they are, these are things you need to reject. And finally, dedicating your purpose to the goal. The purpose of this life is to achieve something that means a great deal to you. So I'll see you after this class is gone, and perhaps tomorrow. See if you can apply these five forces into your life. So by waking up in the morning, set a purpose for this life. Become familiar with it during the day so you don't put in place obstacles. Check, make sure it's, you know, it's virtue. It leads to greater happiness for yourself and others. Whenever anything gets in the road of it, if it's disturbing the motion, put it aside. And back to your purpose, reaffirm your purpose. And at the end of the day, just check and see how you went, and then dedicate your life, rededicate your life to your purpose. Now breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale. Okay, so we've come to the end of our class. So thank you for being here. Gee, what am I doing? I'm going all over the place. Dedication. There we go. Let's dedicate. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain state of room and body and lead all living beings without exception to that enlightened state. May the supreme dual body teacher not get born and rise and grow. May that ball have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to the spell sorrows of the world. Most Holiness, the wish granting, wish fulfilling joy, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind, cleansing guts I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the discovery of Rinpoche and the return. In holding and spreading the meaningless, precious, and complete teachings, their explanations and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable and all good to you, I make this request.